Retina Rounds Podcast 24. Career trajectories rarely follow a linear path. As new opportunities arise, pivoting professionally or adding on new responsibilities takes courage and requires careful consideration. In today's podcast, Retina Rounds is thrilled to welcome an academic and industry leader in our field, Dr. Caroline Baumel. Dr. Baumel is professor of ophthalmology at New England Eye Center, Tufts Medical Center, and chief medical officer at Apellis Pharmaceuticals. She's a prolific researcher, renowned educator, compassionate clinician, and is now shaping the future of pharmacologic innovation. Dr. Baumel talks about how she has navigated these professional roles and the values that have kept her motivated to continue to innovate and break barriers. Let's check it out.
Welcome, everybody, to Retina Rounds Weekly Podcast. We're joined this week for our Women in Retina series with Caroline Baumel. And Caroline is at Tufts, and she's the CMO of Apellis, which is leading the way in anti-complement treatment for dry macular degeneration and geographic atrophy. Caroline, welcome to Retina Rounds. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
It is just so wonderful. Let's start off with a little bit about you personally and your journey. So many international contributors in retina, and many people don't realize you're one of them. Tell us about how you came to retina and medicine.
Thanks, Steve. So yes, I'm originally from Toronto, Canada. And that is where I did my medical school, my ophthalmology residency. Before that, I did undergraduate in biochemistry at McGill University. And when I was applying for fellowship, originally my plan was to do medical retina. And I wanted to train somewhere where I could learn something that was different than what I was doing in Toronto. So I decided to come to the States for 1 year to do a fellowship. And you can see it's been a very long year. I was drafted. I was enticed to stay after that. And actually, after my 1 year fellowship at Tufts, which was not just medical retina, I'll tell you a little bit more about that after, I ended up doing a 2-year fellowship at Wills, and then I came back to Tufts.
Wow. And what got you interested in medicine from the get-go? Were you all, did you know you were going to be a doctor when you started studying biochemistry, or did somebody or something influence you to go into medicine?
Well, my father is a physician. He was a pathologist, and his specialty was kidney disease. And then when I was young, he went back to school to get his PhD in immunology. And I think I was always interested in science. I worked in a few labs, including his lab, when I was in med school. And I realized that I love science, but I didn't want to be in a lab. So I think that's what got me interested in medicine. Also, unfortunately, when my father was pretty young, he got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And we had to deal with a lot of doctors. And in many ways, that made me want to be a physician and kind of want to be a physician that interacts like closely with patients, you know, especially when you're a physician, you have to give bad news to patients. It can be, you know, really meaningful. And I experienced that as a teenager, you know, getting bad news about my father from his physician. So I wanted to do it better. That was really my goal.
You know, Caroline, that answers my next question, because you're so compassionate, you're so connected to patients, and you and I have had lots of conversations over the years about the satisfaction that comes from that relationship and providing the trust and the love and the compassion, empathy, really, that's necessary to really improve the patient's journey. And it doesn't surprise me at all to learn that you had a personal experience with medicine and it was positive, but you even wanted to improve even on that. And so as you train fellows and residents over the decades in Boston, how have you personally been able to communicate and emphasize the importance of forming that relationship, besides just role modeling it, which I know is super important and you do anyway?
Well, I think we are so fortunate to do retina. But patients, when they come to see us, these are the sort of things I tell the fellows, like every patient that comes to see us, especially the first time, the one thing in their mind is, am I going blind? Even the patients that come in, they just have a single floater. We think that, oh, it's just a floater, it's nothing. But every patient who comes to see a retina specialist, what we do is so foreign to most patients and even other specialties in medicine. So I just try to have fellows understand that. Like, we really have to listen to patients, especially the first time. And, you know, it's hard. I think as retina physicians, we're in a tough place. We are in a system that needs us to see a lot of patients efficiently, but yet there's a lot of people that need certain things from us. So, you know, I've had this conversation with some of my patients, especially patients who, you know, need to have a lot. Like, you know, I say, like, let's go through everything this time, and maybe next time it will be a little bit faster, right? Because it's hard to give everything to every patient every time you see them. So it's just good to know what their underlying fears are. Sometimes I call patients at night. I did a lot of ROP, for example. I just called a patient's family this morning just to make sure they knew when their follow-up was. And if you have patients, especially long-term patients, they really appreciate having a phone call once in a while, or especially if they didn't understand something when they came in.
So going the extra mile in personal communication, and I hear you telling your fellows to listen and to act on what they hear. That's so critical. And that's why you've got this incredible tree of fellows that you've participated in training, and it's amazing. A lot of us have the good fortune of doing fellowships at centers where something new and exciting and disruptive is coming forward, and you are a prime example of that. Explain to our listeners what it was like to be there at the germination of OCT. Many of our listeners don't realize that you were an integral part of the development of OCT and on that team that brought OCT, translated it from the lab into patient care. So tell us a little bit about that journey and what it was like to be around something that you recognized might be really disruptive and really exciting.
Sure. So, I mean, originally the reason I chose to do medical retina at Tufts was because it was really groundbreaking at that time with regards to research on retinal manifestations of AIDS. Jay Duker was a big part of that. We actually did the trials for the CMV, the implant that went into the eye for that. And so that was something I was really interested in, that I wanted to, like, my plan was originally to go back to Toronto. And when
Sorry
I
for interrupting. Most young retina specialists don't know what a scourge CMV retinitis was and how many patients just overwhelmed centers with the number of detachments, the number of patients with infectious retinitis, and how hard it was to treat, and how what a breakthrough the pharmacokinetics and local delivery of the antiviral agents were. So it's not a surprise that that was exciting to you.
right. And that's right. It was called the ganciclovir implant. Before that was available, we used to inject patients 3 times a week, remember, to get the drug level high enough. It was a big area of research, and that changed when we were able to improve the CD4 counts in these patients. But that's originally why I came to work with Jay on that. And there were a couple other, many other people in the country that were very involved in that. So I came to Tufts and I got here, and the MIT team and quite a few research students, and Carmen Pugliafito and Joel Schumann and others here were working on the OCT prototype. And I got very involved in working on this prototype. So what's it like? It's like having this unique piece of equipment, and there's always engineers around to fix it or swap out a laser, you know, turning a lot of dials and getting it up and running every day. And we got these amazing, you know, cross-sectional pictures of the retina. And of course, I can't forget Jim Fujimoto and his entire lab. All these students were here all the time. And, you know, Dr. Pugliafito would walk around the clinic with a picture of a macular hole, this is amazing. This is the most amazing thing ever. I mean, really had a lot of vision for this. And OCT was originally, touted to be a way to get a retinal-like quality imaging biopsy of the eye, where you could see pathologic details without having to do a pathology sample. And it was a great time. It was ups and downs, frustrations, and successes that go back and forth. There was research teams, people were writing papers, and it really, continued my interest in retina. Also kind of made me want to do that, combined with the ganciclovir implant, made me change my trajectory from just doing medical retina and lasers to also wanting to do surgery.
Well, it's no surprise. The intersection of invention, innovation, disruption, where it's going to have a huge impact, and you can tell immediately that this is so different, is super exciting. I've been really lucky to help with the development of some imaging projects like the ultra wide angle Optos and the RetCam for kids. And these imaging projects where the engineers are around and you're tweaking it and getting rid of the artifacts or making sure that it's reliable or getting the color just right and the depth of focus and so on is just so exciting. But it also speaks to something else, which I want to just ask you about. Boston is such a unique hub of innovation and invention. Just to amplify a little bit about what it's like to have an MIT lab come over and work in the clinic. I mean, what a treat.
Oh, it was amazing to have these. We've continued that on our collaboration between Tufts and MIT, but to have these brilliant young PhD students come over and work on getting things like real-time imaging, not having to, people don't realize that sometimes the images had to be processed after they were taken, and there had to be software to flatten the OCT images, right? If you think about it, an OCT image should be curved. So there's software to flatten, and everything has to be validated, and lasers have to be attached to the machine. So it's really great to work with these brilliant people around us. I will say the other thing that Tufts was really well known for back then was also laser research. And again, Joel Schumann and Carmen Pugliafito and Roger Steinert had done a lot of this, and Wellman Labs, they really spearheaded a lot of this. And we don't see that as much nowadays because many of the things we used to treat with laser were replaced with anti-VEGF. But when I was a fellow and then into my young career, my younger attending career, I worked on photodynamic therapy with a different agent that didn't make it commercially, but also worked very well. It was called tin-etiopurpurin from Myrivant Medical Technologies. And we did the phase two studies for that. So it was really interesting and exciting to do that at that time.
There's so much in there to unpack. Let's just talk for a minute about mentorship. Your mentors are many, but one that I'm gravitating to is Jay Duker. Tell me what it was like to work with Jay in the early days. I love Jay and have nothing but admiration and wonderment when I look at his career trajectory. So tell us what it was like to work with Jay and why that was so special.
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with Jay since I don't want to say, but let's say almost 30 years. And he's really the reason I came here. I was at the International Congress of Ophthalmology in Toronto when I was a maybe a second year resident, and I happened to go to a luncheon about HIV, and there were a lot of other people there. I remember Janet Davis was there, other people that were involved in HIV retinopathy research. And Jay just stood up and, he's so insightful and gave a very, brilliant answer about something. And I just said, this is the person I want to work with. So I encourage, med students and residents and fellows out there to like go to these things sometimes. I mean, it was very random that I went to this luncheon, and then I went up to Jay Duker after. Not, I was pretty shy back then, actually, but I just went up and I said, do you offer a fellowship? I would love to come work with you. And that's really helped me in my career elsewhere, just kind of seeing someone give a talk and maybe going up to them after, or emailing them, or learning about their research and then reaching out to them. So I think Jay and I have been collaborators over the last 30 years. He also went to industry, and I have gone now. I work in industry. I'm also still seeing patients at Tufts and still doing surgery, which is why I'm in my scrubs today. And I think we've had very similar pathways throughout the decades.
So Jay's principled approach and stepwise approach and ability to think clearly and incisively about whatever problem he's focused on has really characterized his career, and that's clearly rubbed off on you. You're very similar that way. If there was one feature about working with Jay, what would you say it is? Is the maybe the most influential feature? My guess is that it's going to be encouragement, because I think Jay it divests his own ego and wants to see everybody succeed. But what do you think it is?
Well, I think the best thing about Jay, and I miss it now because his office used to be beside me, is that he has three boys and I have three boys. And he was very insightful on how to raise boys. Of course, encouraging and smart, and we think very similarly about cases, but it is that personal connection also that we had, like, able to help me understand family things. I mean, that is negotiating, navigating, excuse me, navigating those things can be very difficult when you're a busy retina surgeon, and navigating through that, he was very, very helpful, especially as we're both in the three boy club. And everything else, of course, being a practical retina person, you know, understanding what's right for the patient? When do you stop? Very hard thing to know. When do you stop? When do you say, I can't help this? I need you to see another colleague. This is, you know, might be a better place for you. So Jay was always my second opinion person, and I think I was always his second opinion person too. We really, you know, understood each other in that way.
You're super fortunate. And let me ask you a tough question, which is, how did you, speaking of navigating, tell us how you navigated the invariable barriers that came with being a woman in medicine?
Absolutely. I mean, well, when I look around now at a meeting, it's amazing. There's so many females at meetings. We've had so many female fellows as well. But when I was a fellow myself, there were less women in retina. It was a very surgical specialty. There were probably less women in ophthalmology. And I have a classic picture of myself. I showed it when I got the VBS mentorship award. I have a picture of myself, and I'm with the whole staff of New England Eye Center. It's me and like 25 men, and we all have a cigar. So it's a classic picture from back then. I think that it's always helpful to look for mentors amongst the people that you train with. There were just less women overall in retina back then, but there were certainly some amazing women, you know, Julia Haller and Susan Bressler and Judy Kim and Jenny Lim were just a little bit older than myself, Maria Barakal, but there were just less of us out there. So I think taking that away, I try to be a mentor for the younger women that come through our department or anyone, whether it's part of ASRS Women in Retina. But there's no perfect formula for everyone. My advice to a young woman is, you know, do everything you can to get as much help as you can. If you have to navigate family things, whether that's living with family or getting, you know, assistance in the home, and your life will change. So my life has changed. Now my kids are going to college, and I'm able to spend more time, focused on research. When they were young tweens, I think that was the busiest time for me, actually, with doing stuff for them. And you can't be everywhere at once, so you have to decide what's important for you.
So the work-life balance and family and are obviously the priority, but as you were coming up, how did you navigate barriers when I think you probably had to do more than your male colleagues to be recognized, and you probably had to do more, you had to achieve more, and you probably felt internally, I mean, I'm asking you, did you feel internally that you had to be at 125% all the time? Because Carolyn, I look at you and you are Superwoman. And so you're mother of three, accomplished academician. Now you're a titan of industry. We'll come to that, but in your own internal dialogue or your own personal philosophy, can you share what was the secret? Was it just work harder than everybody else? Was it do better than everybody else? How did you find the strength to get up when you got knocked down? Invariably you did, and I'm sure without knowing the details, that some of that had to do with misogyny. It had to have.
Well, I will say that I rarely took things personally, and I'm a believer that, people sometimes say things they don't mean, or maybe they come out wrong. I really don't take things personally that other people say. And I try to use comments to help me grow. And, we all say things sometimes. Put our foot in our mouth and after are like, why did we say that? Or maybe weren't thinking about something. So I really don't take things to heart, and
That's
I let
a
a lot of things
magical, that's a
roll off.
magical perspective. That's a
Yes.
magical perspective because really what you did is you, instead of taking offense, you just took it as an opportunity to grow.
That's right. I mean, most people want to be nice and want to get along. Sometimes people just say things, they don't know how you're feeling, or might be a bad day, you might take it the wrong way. It goes all ways. So I really let everything slide off me. I mean, especially when I was a fellow, I really didn't take things to heart. I just wanted to operate like I see most fellows. And then I would say I always, thought, look better, work harder. Be smarter. Like, really, if I was going to speak on the podium, I made sure that I tried to read everything about that topic before I got on the podium. It was really important to me to be an expert in anything I was working on.
Ah, that's genius. So, Carolyn, let's talk a little bit about the transition from academia into industry, because a lot of people are interested in that, and resources in academia have been shrinking a little bit, and resources in industry have been going up a little bit, and one can hook onto a spectacular technology that may make a real impact on society and. And so there's a lot of motivation to swap over to industry. And you had some mentors that did that. You mentioned Jay moved over. Elias, Rochelle spent a lot of time working with industry. Mike Goldstein in your department spent a lot of time in industry. So there are some really, really great academicians, clinicians, surgeons who have transitioned and kept a foot in both worlds and then either moved all the way over or managed to continue to straddle. What motivated you? And I know you had a lot of opportunity and worked a lot with industry before you took a position with Apellis. So, talk to me about what got you excited about dipping your toe into industry and then stepping over.
Well, I had done a lot of work with Apellis before I joined there. I had originally presented on some renal mediated drusen in a patient. I had done a case report with David Lally, and that's how I got to know Apellis. And then I was an investigator in their phase three studies. I also felt like at Tufts, I had done so many things. I was a professor. I was mentoring students, teaching fellows, in charge of the medical retina fellowship. So when the opportunity came up to join Apellis as chief medical officer, I thought that this would be a great place to really work more on the science of a novel new mechanism of action. And I joined Apellis before Syfovre pegcetacoplan was FDA approved. I got to be a part of that process and work with all of the brilliant people there that were working on that. And now, subsequent to approval, I get to work on all of the science and the data that we can find from the two phase three Oaks and Derby study and the long-term open label extension study, GALE. So it's an opportunity for me to hone in on the data and work on data that is meaningful to our colleagues, right? We want to give retina physicians and patients meaningful points that they can use to decide if it's the appropriate treatment for them. So I really love that part of what I'm doing. The other thing that people might not know is that systemic pegcetacoplan, which is the trade name Empaveli, is also approved for a systemic disease, PNH, paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria, and last week was approved for C3G and IC-MPGN, which are kidney diseases. So I'm also involved in that part of the company, working on the systemic approvals and medical affairs. So it's a unique opportunity. And Steve, I'll tell you one thing that as a physician, I didn't really understand all the different facets that went into industry. And now I have a much better understanding. So it's been a great experience for me. I've been able to work in medical affairs, development, understand all the other processes that go into having a product approved and the post-approval issues.
You know, Carolyn, it's clear that you're passionate about this, and it's clear that you get a real opportunity to learn and grow, and that's probably the motivation in part. But it's also clear that, and it's clear to the public, I mean, the treating physician public, when I say the public, the medical community, having you personally as the CMO of Apellis differentiates that company in a way that virtually no other company in the space has been able to do in retina. You, one of us in the catbird seat, so to speak, is really amazing because your reputation for patients first, not just safety, but kindness and compassion, is gives all of us treating physicians a tremendous amount of comfort when we reach for a drug. And that's very special. And on behalf of the retina community, you know, we thank you for being brave enough to step over there and to do that. And frankly, you've overseen a couple of approvals now and as CMO and continuing to innovate. I had the opportunity, as you know, for the first time in my career to interact with Apellis in a meaningful way just last week. And I was just absolutely impressed by the science and the care that's gone into your new investigational trials, as well as the leadership. But mostly, I'm impressed with how involved you are in patient safety and outcomes for patients. It's clearly a patient-first operation. Tell us a little bit about, if you care to, a little bit about the post-hoc analyses on functionality from your studies. We all know that the complement inhibition provided by your agent slows the growth of geographic atrophy. But, and that was an approvable endpoint. But there was a lot of controversy about how clinically significant it was and is it meaningful and so on. But if we just leave those approvable endpoints to the side, what did we learn about, what have you learned about the transition zone? What can you tell us about the effects of your drug on the viable retina that's maybe compromised but not gone? Because I think for me that was really eye-opening.
Right. So, well, I will. Well, we can start this answer by just saying GA is a little bit harder than wet AMD. And I like to think of it like wet AMD neovascular AMD, whatever you want to call it, is an acute disease, right? Retina's thickened, we inject with an anti-VEGF that improves, and the treatments are temporary that comes back and we have a different sort of tempo. Geographic atrophy, it's a different disease. It's chronic, and these treatments are disease modifying, right? They modify the rate of growth, which is what actually we do in many other systemic diseases. We have learned a lot about geographic atrophy from the Oaks Derby and Gale study, and I have learned a lot myself. And I think that some of the most meaningful data that we have is the microperimetry data and the artificial intelligence data that we have. And what we did show on microperimetry was that treatment with pegcetacoplan reduced loss at the junctional zone of retina tissue and of photoreceptors. And this was confirmed looking at these regions with artificial intelligence. So, often people will say, well, it wasn't a pre-specified endpoint, but when these studies started, 2018, 2019, when they were designed, even before that, I don't think we were at that place technologically. Microperimetry seems to be the most meaningful functional endpoint. And this was not just shown in post-hoc analysis from our studies, but this was also shown looking at the studies that evaluated lampalizumab. They also found that with microperimetry. And in the future, AI and evaluation of retina OCT scans and combining that with microperimetry will probably be able to show this useful functional endpoint prospectively to patients and physicians.
So it sounds like you're discovering, to distill this, you're discovering other effects of the treatment protocols than you studied in the as primary and secondary pre-specified endpoints, and these effects may be much more clinically significant for patients. Is that correct?
Correct. So pre-specified, the endpoint, which was, accepted by the FDA, was growth of geographic atrophy on fundus autofluorescence. And now I think that physicians have told us that, well, they think that's meaningful or not, maybe not, that OCT might be more meaningful to physicians to look at that. And they would like that combined with something functionally. So, can we use that combined with microperimetry or an AI model of microperimetry to help us demonstrate the effects of medications on geographic atrophy? So, that's something that we're really interested in. And Apellis is a biotech company, and we have a product, but we're also really interested in functional endpoints and tools for physicians to use with their patients. So that is a major directive. And I'm really happy to be a part of it because it goes along with everything I've been interested for the
Well, your
last decade.
contributions to OCT combined with your contributions to dry AMD, it's a perfect match. Is there a particular innovation in OCT, maybe the functional OCT coming out of Europe, or the AI coming out of Europe, or is it both that you're most excited about?
Well, I'm most excited about using AI as a way to improve on microperimetry and align it with OCT. What does this mean? That means having a functional model of OCT. I know that most physicians aren't going to want to do microperimetry in their office. I'm sure you would feel the same way. I personally would not want to be doing microperimetry in
Well,
my
it's
office.
because patients don't want to do it, right? It's not that the physicians don't want to do it. It's just that patient welfare and patient flow, patient journey just don't dovetail with the way microperimetry is right now. But that's not to say that it can't change. I mean, let's not forget, OCT wasn't fast at the beginning either.
That's right. That's right. So, I think for us working on a model of that uses OCT parameters and is able to give functional information will be something that is important in the future, but more to tell next time I come on, Steve.
Yeah, absolutely. And I didn't mean to push you into a tight spot and have you divulge anything that you can't or didn't divulge. But I will say, an extremely impressive chief executive officer, chief scientific officer, and of course, chief medical officer at Apellis. And it, again, I just want to emphasize for the retina community, for the young audience out there, it's really important to feel comfortable reaching out to Caroline and Apellis. They are a better company because Caroline's there and brings her retinal expertise to the forefront at such a senior level. Let's talk, pivot back to career advice. Our audience is global, and a lot of people are at a crossroads. They're trying to decide where to do their fellowship, or where to take a job, or how to target their achievement in their new job. So let's start with what you tell your residents about how to choose retina, or how to choose a field, and if it's retina, how to choose a fellowship. What do you advise in terms of what to look for? Meaning, is it personal fit? Is it the academic accomplishments of the training programs that they have an opportunity to shop? What is it for you that you advise your residents when choosing a career in retina?
Well, of course, I always encourage a career in retina. And when I look back at my own personal path, remember, I originally came to Tufts. I did medical retina and lasers, and just by chance happened to be able to work on OCT. And then during my time, I realized I wanted to do surgery. I mean, Jay Duker looked at me, I was assisting him during a case, and he goes, "I don't know why you're not doing retina surgery. You have the mind of a retinal surgeon. You should be doing surgery." So after that, I went to Wills, and at that time, I did surgical retina. I also did pediatric retina surgery, and I was able to do ocular oncology at that time. So I would say, I tell my fellows, I do encourage them sometimes if you're thinking about surgical retina, but you're not sure medical or surgical. You know, if you do surgical retina, you could do, of course, both when you're finished. I think it's important to really pursue your desire at that time when you want to be a fellow and try to get some papers written when you're a resident if you can, which is not always possible. I mean, some busy residencies, you know, Steve, you can't get much done research-wise. You're just too busy. I think it's important to consider what's good for your family. And that's not just for fellowship, but that's really when you go out to get a job, right? If you can be somewhere where your spouse is happy or you have family around you, that always seems to be a really key important point. And I think.
Culturally, what culturally would you do you emphasize cultural fit for your trainees? Do you suggest to them that they assess their own personal values and try and dovetail it? Or sometimes we've had experts in retina advising their fellows to look for a cultural fit. We've had other really great people advise look for something that makes you uncomfortable in training. That's really going to stretch you because you can. It's only 2 years. You're going to be totally immersed either way. And maybe you want to grow, and maybe it's discomfort that makes you grow rather than comfort. I'm just curious where you fall on that spectrum.
Well, I think for fellowship, you should go to where you're going to be able to see the most patients and, you know, get the most experience. It will make the rest of your life easier. And of course, even for our fellows here, you know, I always say, like, you should try to see every patient in the clinic. Even if it's not your patient, if the resident saw it, go see the patient if you have time, because we are very visual people in ophthalmology. And if you see something once, you will not forget it. So, fellow saw a lesion yesterday. They didn't know what it was. I went in, I looked, I'm like, pea scrap, you know, done. How many times have I seen that? Not many times. Seen it presented more, but we're very visual.
Tell the audience what that is.
So PSCRAP is presumed solitary circumscribed retinal astrocytic proliferation. And typically it looks like a white, round, circular, slightly elevated pearl on the retina. It's benign. I've seen it very few times. It's been presented at conferences, some of the Januzzi rounds or at the fluorescein clubs. But we're very visual. So go in. Sometimes you see one of these little lesions, it looks the same. You see something else. And that's why I encourage fellows, see as much as you can because it will stay with you throughout your career.
And when you're advising fellows on their job search, do you push towards academia, push towards a better fit for that person, push towards private practice? How do you advise them, or do you go up a level and just say, let's find a cultural fit for you? How do you, or do you just listen? And there's no right answer as a mentor. What's your style?
My style is I listen. I've seen from previous fellows that if they have a spouse or family, that really ends up being, in many ways, the most important consideration for happiness. And I think academia's changed in ophthalmology. There's a lot of people in private practice that are doing research, so I wouldn't let that sway things. But it's hard to advise people. I had one fellow, Mike Ip. I think you know Mike Ip. And
My
I
colleague
didn't,
and partner for years. Great
that's right.
guy.
I didn't think he was going to do academia, and he's had this amazing career. I had another fellow who I always, you know him, Darren Goldman. Amazing. I,
We
thought.
trained Darren, was a resident with us, and then he was lucky enough to match in your program. And Darren is a gem and could have easily been a professor.
Oh, brilliant. So I hope he doesn't mind us talking about him. He was brilliant. He probably wrote the most papers out of any fellow. He would come in today. I had an unusual case of Valsalva retinopathy. He goes, oh, I wrote it up, got it published, very quickly, very motivated, and but still is doing a little bit of research in his private practice. I mean, sometimes it's really hard to know, but one of the great things I tell fellows is you can go back and forth between academia and private practice. People do it all the time. And we're lucky in retina, you can do research in private practice.
Absolutely. Let's close with a discussion about personal satisfaction. What, when one of the fellows comes to you and says, Dr. Baumol, if you look back at your career from a high level, what is it that's given you the most satisfaction? Is it personal interactions with patients? Is it giving back to the community a sense of contributing? Is it the collegiality? Is it everything? Is it something I haven't mentioned? They're looking now. And rightfully so, for personal satisfaction. What's going to help be a balm for that burning fire to feel good about themselves at the end of the day? What is it for you, Carolyn, to this point that has given you the most satisfaction professionally?
Well, that is a tough question, Steve, because there's been so many things that I love in retina. I love working with the retina fellows. That's probably been what's kept me in academics for so long. I love to see them at meetings. I love when they reach out to me and send me texts or pictures about updates in their life. I love working with patients too. I have some patients who call me, they want to discuss other things. And industry has been something amazing, and I'm so fortunate that I've been able to continue to see patients, work with fellows, do surgery, and work in industry the other, 24/7. I mean, it's an amazing thing to do. But I think one of the best things and what feeds me the most about retina is actually our amazing colleagues. I was just at ASRS last week. I saw you, and I mean, I look back at our career and we have the best people in retina. Always people who are warm, so intelligent, and always pushing the limits for what's the next best thing for patients. So when I look back, I feel very fortunate to be working with amazing colleagues like yourself, like so many of our other colleagues. I mean, I never get tired of meeting people. I go to a meeting. It was post-COVID. I'm like, oh, I probably shouldn't hug people. But you see so many people that come up for a hug. It's so great to see our colleagues and just catch up with them, even if it's for a few minutes. So I think that it's really our colleagues that make this field so great. And it's a global thing too, not just in the US.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and thank you for sharing that. Well, and thank you for all of your contributions to our field. You've continued to disrupt and move us forward and challenge us, and your kindness and your warmth towards patients and colleagues is legendary. And your innovation and leadership at Apellis makes the retina provider community more comfortable to interact. And we're really, really grateful that you've taken the risk and the leadership opportunities there and done so much with it. So, Carolyn Baumel, thanks for joining us on Retina Rounds today. And to our audience out there, I'm going to offer you to reach out to Caroline if you have qu more questions or interactions that you wish to have. Caroline, thank you very much for being with us today. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. It's been an honor to come here.
If you enjoyed this video, please visit us at retinarounds.com. There you can sign up for our email list. You'll get a notification every time a new video is posted. And if you have an interesting video or a tip or trick that you'd like to share, please follow the links on our website and you can upload your video there. Thanks so much for watching.